Hi, I'm Patrick Palm, and this is the Learn from Leaders podcast. In this show, I interview favorite customers and other interesting leaders in product development, marketing, HR, executive management, investors. You find favorite leaders in many different places and in organizations doing game development and publishing, software as a service and other tech companies and big enterprises, you know, going from very centralized command and control kind of organizations to a more modern way of working with a culture with high team autonomy and better alignment towards the company goals and values. So let's go.
John, what games do you play yourself right now?
I have a weekly game night with my cousin, and we've been playing through Baldur's Gate 3. And I think we've been playing through the same campaign since probably August, which is when I think it came out last year. So Baldur's Gate 3, I've been meaning to, I've been hearing things about Diablo 4 that make me want to check it out again. There are so many other things that I've been checking out. We just, our team recently checked out the Tiny Glade demo, which was super, super cool. Very, very cute, very playful. Recently played Dave the Diver for the first time. Recently checked out the new, I can't remember the name of it, but there's a very clever game about a hermit crab that I've been meaning to check out recently that's been getting some traction. So yeah, I'm all over the place.
Do you play in your team with Unknown Worlds?
Oh yeah, I mean, some of these things are things we deliberately checked out as a team. We have every Friday the team I'm on has a sort of optional sort of happiest hour chat towards the end of the day, the afternoon. I mean, for some people it's the afternoon, but for some of us it's evening.
Make me think of.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. I was just gonna say, you make me think about this movie, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Have you seen it?
I haven't, but I am aware of it, and that it was a thing that many people were watching at one point.
Yeah, and it's about the first sushi restaurant that got 3 Michelin stars in Tokyo, yeah. And there's a scene, you know, where the main person says that, you know, if you're going to be the best at making sushi, you need to eat a lot of sushi. And I guess it's a little bit the same here with games, that if you're going to make some, you know, truly amazing games, you also have to play a lot of games. Oh. Do you think that's a correct statement, by the way?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the same is true for so many mediums. I think I have an English degree. So the first advice you get in college when you're doing creative writing is you better be reading a lot. And so I think there are a lot of, you know, even in the industry, you can get by not being maybe the most current in games and being more current in your specialty or your tech. But boy, does it help to just be seeing what other people are working on and to get you out of your bubble and your comfort zone. There are more games being released now than ever before. And it is just bonkers the amount of cool stuff people are creating that if this selection had been available to me when I was a little bit, I feel so old saying that, but I just would have had my head exploded with joy seeing the options.
So on that topic, I mean, what's your take on, the industry right now? There's obviously quite a lot of discussions in connection with, you know, many people being laid off, discussions around, you know, what's actually the problem, you know, is it only about kind of a correction after potentially overhiring during COVID? You know, you often have an opinion that would know it's more complex than that, but I would love to hear your view.
Oh, heavy sigh. I mean, it's such a big topic. I think there's like a heavily online crowd, in society in general, but even in games, I think the folks who are online more have a little bit bleaker a perspective And I'm not sure that's right or wrong, but I tend to have a slightly more optimistic view of things. That said, heavy disclaimer, like I think the trend that is happening right now is extraordinarily disruptive, and not just to, you know, obviously not just to the industry as a whole, but we forget that each person here has a life and decisions. And I've talked to developers who had just closed down houses or just, you know, moved to a new location and had their livelihoods sort of suddenly and without warning, maybe stripped away from them. And so there's a tremendous human cost here that I think when we're looking at the sheer numbers, we can almost lose sight of it. And so I think disruption is really the word to be discussing when talking about this, not just to the human part of it, but also we have, I think, more so than maybe similar cycles I've seen in the past in games, this feels like, you know, the discussion around AI and other emerging technologies gives it a sort of, it gives it a different taste, right? I tend to think that the AI adoption is going to be a little bit slower than other people think. And you can't really separate the conversations about like, hey, what are the projections we're making about what a game should cost? What decisions have we made? And are there, what kinds of, not just at studio levels, but sort of high level in the business of games, but what assumptions go into what it takes to build a game and how many people we need to do it and what sorts of tools are at their disposal to do it. And so I really don't blame folks for having a sort of shapeless anxiety about the future of things. And it affects it. And again, the word disruption, it affects the people who are also, you know, currently unaffected by the wave of layoffs, but are you know, it's constantly on our minds. You know, we had a company All Hands recently where it, of course it came up, you know, people are concerned about, hey, everything seems positive, everything feels good, but hey, this happened to this other studio or my friend. And, you know, people, it makes you look at the world around you with a slightly different tint or a lens.
When do you, I mean, this is a tough question, but when do you think we'll start seeing? Well, let's put it this way: it's a two-part question. When do you think we start seeing things changing, going back to more positive? And what do you think are the positive things that will come out of this? So, if we move on from the negative impacts that you addressed, you know, what do you think are the good stuff that's going to come out of this? And when do you think we're going to start seeing a bit, let's say, better mood in the industry?
I feel like there are two questions there. When will we see a better mood in the industry, I think, is different than when will we start to see the positives. The mood, I mean, I've been in games for, I'm approaching the 20-year mark, maybe in the next couple of years here. And I don't think anybody's ever in a good mood. I don't know. Maybe we're a bunch of pessimists, but I always feel like there's, we've sort of been trained that, like, you know, your loyalty isn't always rewarded and things like that. So I don't know that the mood is necessarily a good indicator, but what I do think is that, the positives, and I feel like this is maybe a false binary too, right? Like I think, you know, I've been reflecting a lot recently just about my career and personally and about how I view the world. And I almost think that we have these maybe false binaries. And so we have this habit of saying it's all good or it's all bad. And I was just talking to somebody who was recently laid off, and we were on a call together as a result. And we were talking about how disruption, sort of, we end up siloed a lot in games, not just in our departments, not just in our projects, but as whole studios, right? And I think that we have mechanisms for sharing amongst each other, things like Game Developers Conference and stuff like that. Like that's, yes, let's take that for granted. But when it comes to even forming connections with people at other studios, I think we connect with the people we're being creative with, and we suddenly have a bunch of people who are going, hey, my studio's no longer around, or my the project that I was really excited about is no longer funded, and we're looking outside of our studios and projects for connection. And so the conversation, again, the conversation I was just having was, hey, I didn't know you before this happened, and it's forcing a lot of us to look around, not just at who else is in the industry, but what else can be a part of my creative experience other than just my like heads down experience of this project. And so, yeah, I don't know. This is me. I'm maybe being too philosophical here or too rambly, but I do think that there's always an opportunity to recontextualize the world around us, to look around. We can actually see who our community is, because it's not necessarily just these companies, these studios, and these projects, but it's actually, there's a whole industry here, and there are all sorts of smart, talented, creative people I haven't met. And boy, is it nice. Boy, does it suck that the context is so negative, but it is also nice to meet these people and connect with them. And yeah, I don't know. There's no like all good or all bad experience of the world, I think. And I think it's important to recognize that.
So, John, I think one question I'm always curious about with everyone that I interview, and to be honest, I have a tendency to ask this to people outside of, you know, podcasting and our interviews as well. And that is, you know, what was the biggest crossroads in your career?
Oh, well, yeah, the biggest crossroads was, yeah, that's an easy moment to identify. Made the transition in 2016 to a different studio. I sort of, quote unquote, like grew up at one studio in Boston over at Harmonix, making music games, dance games, like Rock Band, that sort of stuff. And so, yeah, my first opportunity after that was at another studio. And I sort of bounced off that experience a little bit and found myself questioning, what did I want out of a career in video games? And I ended up, after a year or two of doing that gig, I actually landed in education for a minute. And so, yeah, I spent some time at the Rochester Institute of Technology working for the Magic Center there, and working with student teams, coaching them. And it was a really cool opportunity because not just for me, but for the students, because they were getting like up to $10,000 stipends to go develop their projects with professional coaching, you know? So it was really fun. It was a really fun crossroads for me because I got to, it sort of had the impact of injecting me with a more childlike enthusiasm for what it is that we actually do and why I got into games to begin with. Sort of seeing this joy about game making reflected back at me from these students was really cool.
What did you bring from that? I mean, it sounds like simply a more, curious, the curious child, so to say here, bringing that into whatever you're doing, Nick, sounds fantastic. But, were there also more, let's say, new skills or other experiences that you feel like you've been having use for at Unknown Worlds now?
Yeah, so many things. I think maybe the biggest thing was sort of a reset on my perspective, where I talked about this a little bit earlier, but I just think we can get so siloed in these multi-year like monolithic game projects, and it's easy to lose sight of like, hey, there's other stuff out there for me. There are other people in the world. There are other connections to make. There are other interests to have. And I think being around students and where for me, the product wasn't a video game that we had to launch, it was actually growing humans. that I'll never, you know, that's a thing there that I don't think I'll ever, that has left a lasting imprint on me for sure. And then also just remembering that so many of the problems we face in video games are much simpler than we think, right? They're foundational. They're fundamentals about, hey, are our expectations aligned? What do we want to get out of this? I could go on a 38 minute tangent just about how almost every problem we have are people problems and are based around our misaligned expectations about what we're trying to get out of this.
So before going deeper into that, I think it might be helpful for, you know, for me to just understand a little bit deeper, you know, what, can you just tell a bit more about Unknown Worlds? You know, because and to me, it's all about Subnautica, and I have played it, quite an extraordinary game. But I can, you know, can you just tell me a little bit more? You know, just have a little bit deeper understanding for, you know, what you really are about in terms of, you know, what games you're making, what games you want to make, you know, what you know, like the, you know, the identity of the studio. Because, you know, to me, it's just, you know, I met you, I met some of your colleagues, you know, I know a little bit about Subnautica. You know, I think it's super cool that you've been remote first for quite a while. But yeah, you know, what's the deeper story about Unknown Worlds?
Yeah, I think, and the disclosure is, right, like I came to Unknown Worlds back in 2020, which is peak pandemic, but the studio has been around for close to 20 years, I think, at this point. It was founded by Charlie Cleveland and Max McGuire, and they sort of ran at like a pretty lean size for a ton of their life cycle, and they didn't have people. I mean, people there functioned as project managers, but nobody. They didn't have producers until probably I think 2019 or 2020 was their first hire there, and so I think, when I think about the sort of origins of Unknown Worlds, it's really like a studio of creators who have put the relationship with their audience of players first. So one of the things the studio talks a lot about is an open development process. And Unknown Worlds helped pioneer through early access what a player developer collaboration could really look like. And it's interesting because that all has evolved, because other studios have sort of also studied some of those practices and done it their own way or made their own modifications or invented it all, sort of in parallel. Yeah, I think if you look at something like early access on Steam now, you have like these highly polished games coming out, and you have studios testing like a narrower slice, and players, of course, have come to expect a higher level of polish. And so there's even an evolving conversation about what does the developer-player collaboration look like. And again, I think that what you asked me about the identity of Unknown Worlds, and I do think that is a huge piece of it.
That's very interesting, because I'm definitely hearing a lot that, you know, we will be moving more in that direction, and that will open up for, well, simply better games. You know, can you elaborate a little bit on where you think, you know, the whole developer player collaboration, where do you think that is heading? I mean, you know, where, how far can you take that?
I mean, yeah, that's a great question. I think that the things that, I'll maybe start with the things that I'm interested in, right? Because I think that Unknown Worlds has had such a radically open development process. I mean, people will actually stream their, you know, somebody will be working on the code for a new feature, and they will stream it on Twitch. And that's like such a radical level of development. Like, it's, you know, if you're not in games, it's hard to really, it's hard to overstate like how protective studios like traditionally have been about their ideas and the execution of them and when do we announce things and that sort of stuff. And I think that really we can spend some time sort of rethinking the model about like what actually helps build enthusiasm among your player base. And so, yeah, if we're talking about where do we think this is all headed, it's really like you see some of the side effects and consequences of this sort of model already, right? It's like the emphasis being placed around different developer events, them being physically based, like things like, you know, we just heard about E3 sort of gasping its last breath. There is a lot more agency among players, and there's a lot more interest among players to access that stuff directly from developers or from the direct access to the development process with developers. So I think the more do I personally think that if we're talking about ROI, like what is the ROI of like a developer streaming code on Twitch? Like, well, maybe we need to improve the sophistication with which we like measure these things, right? Because I think often we end up in situations where like, again, you don't get feedback on your work for sometimes multiple years in games. And even if you've got an audience of like 8 when you're streaming your work, but they're engaged and they're talking to you about your work, like I don't think you can understate maybe the impact that has on even the enthusiasm with which somebody approaches their work. And so, yeah, and this is not going to be for everybody, but yeah, there's so much to tap into here about like just how we get feedback on our work, how do we pull players? How do we make sure we're not biasing towards a certain kind of audience? Like that's the stuff I think that for me, that's personally really interesting is like, how do we increase or improve the signal to noise ratio with that stuff?
The one thing I noticed is that, you know, the AA term versus AAA when we talk about games and studios, you know, that has, there's basically a bit of popularity around that now. I see a lot of studio startups are purposefully, positioning themselves as AA rather than casual or AAA. And I see from kind of investors' point of view that, you know, many investors are right now very interested in AA, and you position yourself as AA as well as a studio. But what does it actually mean? I mean, how would you define, you know, AA versus AAA and casual and so forth?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not like a learned student of the taxonomy here. In part because I think when these sort of classifications come up, you get a lot of eye rolling within the industry. Like we literally just had this conversation last week, and there were actual eye rolls about it. But I think it ends up being more of like a, we roll our eyes because it can be a little bit reductive, right? Like it doesn't tell the whole story about like who a studio is and what they value. And we're, you know, if we only focus on like what is AA or III or whatever you want to call it, you're like losing a lot in that conversation if you're not being careful. That said, I think it's like a helpful way to like sort of brand a studio's or maybe not brand, but to signal a studio's sort of like framing. You know, there's like I think we talked about the state of the industry earlier. There's definitely a reaction against sort of big monolithic publishers. And it's a way to signal like, hey, we're kind of small, like we're indie, we're like scrappy, or we're limited in size, or we're careful, or, and I think maybe that's on the player side. There's a way to signal like, hey, it can be cool. It can be cool to like sign up for this, or like, this is the kind of process that games should be about. Like if people have this sort of weird utopian idea about what game development is in their head, I think it kind of can mean whatever you want to anybody. So I guess I'm being a little cynical here, but I guess on the investor side, it also just signals like, hey, there's like, there's a world here to make amazing games. And this is proven time and time again by what is popular on Steam and even increasingly on console. But there's a way to make games where it's not, you know, a tens of millions of dollar budget to get what you want, or even in some, you know, I know some studios have, you know, multiple hundreds of millions of dollars in budget in the sort of grotesque cases.
Yeah.
And there's still, I still believe there's a place in games for that AAA experience and that budget. It's just not for everybody, and players don't necessarily all need that experience. That's not like a problem that everybody's looking to solve. So yeah.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, I think it's interesting in general with, you know, when you have, you know, terms that's going to signal something that, you know, very often, I mean, this is a bit of a separate thing, but I mean, having been in the Agile community for about 20 years, you know, there's a lot of stuff that kind of goes in the umbrella of, you know, Agile, you know, development and business practices that are truly really good. But then, you know, when something becomes successful, it also becomes a buzzword. And when it becomes a buzzword, you know, there's also problems coming with it where you're going to have, you know, some basically some anti-patterns connected to it. So it gets complicated when it's kind of like, well, the core of it here is something useful and meaningful, but it also, you know, it comes with a tail of some problems as well. And I guess it's the same thing here.
100%. Yeah. I mean, anytime, like, you have things that become like that start as a useful shorthand that end up becoming arguments. And that's the point at which I lose interest, right? Like, okay, we're no longer talking about the thing we started talking about. We're actually talking about something completely different.
Yeah. So when it comes to remote first, I mean, you are, you're a true veteran in that, Unknown Worlds, you know, did remote first for quite a big team, you know, way before, you know, COVID hit and everyone started to think about remote first and hybrid and decisions around that. So before going more deep into that, what was Unknown Worlds remote first from the very, very beginning? You know, you said it's been around for about 20 years, or is this that something that came over time, or, you know, what's the story behind a remote first with Unknown Worlds?
My understanding of like the first few years is admittedly a little fuzzy, but my understanding is like the remote first culture has been ingrained in the studio from the very start. You know, I think there are longtime employees who sort of, they're, you know, on natural selection too, were modders or like competitive players who just started working for the company. They just like showed up. I don't know. This is maybe this is the impression I have. I know the truth is a little bit different, but they sort of showed up at the company and have been working there ever since. And what a cool origin story where you have people whose enthusiasm for what you're building is allowed to infuse in the creation of it, right? And so I think it kind of started there, and I'm sure like Charlie and Max and others who've been at the studio for, you know, since its inception would have like a way more interesting set of things to talk about there. But yeah, the short answer is it's been part of the DNA from the very start for sure.
By the way, I have, you know, it's interesting, you know, there are companies that's been remote first for a very long time, you know, way before it became, you know, fashionable. And I'm thinking about one example, which is Automattic that makes WordPress. And there's a book called A Year Without Pants, written by, it's a great title. But you know, again, this is way before COVID, you know. And everyone would understand this much more, you know, if this book was coming out during COVID. But this was published, you know, a long time ago, and it's basically this software, you know, manager that joined as a team lead, but also did it as a study, and it basically documents that in this book. And I think it's an interesting read. a lot of the, there's actually some, I think that when COVID hit, probably a lot of people would have benefited from reading that book at that point instead of, there was probably a lot of panic reactions that happened.
But, yeah,
but one question I'm very curious about is, when you speak to other people that might not have the remote first experience, what is the, what's the most common misconceptions about it? You know, what is the most common thing, you know, people think, you know, are happening or things that you're doing, but that are actually, you know, misconceptions?
That's funny. You know, I actually don't think, I think there are far fewer of those moments now because everybody ended up working from home during the pandemic. So I think one weird side effect, and this comes up when we're hiring candidates, is like, we almost don't even have to ask questions anymore, or we don't have to go as deep about like, hey, do we think this is a candidate who's a fit for a sort of remote first culture, distributed development a process? Is like, well, everybody sort of had a taste of it at this point, or most people have had a taste of it, and it just comes up less. So I think maybe that's a thing where you have to test for it with less rigor, because I really do think people have a genuine sense now of like, hey, does this work for me? And I remember I even we had a role open like a year or two ago, and I encouraged a really talented friend of mine to apply for it, and she said, nah, remote's not for me. You know, I did it. I can't do it. Like, there are things that I get, there are needs that I have that, that I think a long-term remote position wouldn't be able to fulfill.
I was going to ask, you know, how do you sell it, so to say, but maybe you don't, you know, how do you, you know, when you advertise, you know, for when you're looking for talent, you know, when you're speaking with talent, I mean, how do you have kind of like a pitch, you know, why is like true remote first, you know, really awesome, you know, at unknown worlds, or is it more self-selecting that you actually don't have that pitch, and it's simply, you know, people that want to work remote first are the ones who will naturally apply, or, you know, how does that work for you?
Well, yeah, the answer is yes. I think both things kind of happen. And I also want to say that I'm like terribly uninterested in the maybe unhelpful debate about like which is better. It really is just choices, right? And so I think the pitch that the thing that sells me, because, you know, I'm a producer, and I think a lot of producers historically have looked at remote and gone like, I don't know, how am I going to be effective in that environment? And the pitch for me is just, it's in so many ways, I think, it's human centered in a way that I think sometimes an office culture can sort of, I don't think it's like overt necessarily, but I think there's, the kind of lousy side of office culture is it sort of, hey, we're centering the business. Like, you come here, you meet me here. Whereas with a distributed environment, you know, my dog is laying 2 feet from me. The other day I was able to prepare for a dinner I had that evening because I had a pork shoulder that was braising in the oven. And so I know these are like superficial parts of it, but it extends down into the work, right? I think there's a lot more attention being paid now than there was maybe 20 years ago, or even when I was starting in the industry, about the power of working alone. And the power of quiet time and not having your attention sort of ripped from you. And again, I think there are positive parts about that in an office environment where, hey, like, I can just go to somebody's desk and answer a quick question, which is a bit harder in this environment. But yeah, it centers the human. The other thing that we talk about a ton in the studio is how culturally diverse we are. We have a ton of people in Western Europe, Asian countries as well. We have somebody who works in Japan like months out of the year. We have somebody in Australia, somebody in Brazil. And I just see the world differently now by working alongside folks. I mean, this was the original pitch for the internet, right? It's like, we're going to like blur the boundaries of, I don't know, like of what a country even looks like. And in the work that we do, that blurring happens all the time.
That's an interesting take on it. You know, the kind of like original pitch for the internet versus it. All right, so we're finally getting there. So, you know, when we're talking about talent now, first I kind of just want to make a statement. So, I mean, I get into conversation often about, I mean, you know, the conversation that you said, you know, you don't like, you know, which is better. You know, that's the one I'm getting into all the time.
Yeah.
You know, since you know, we're you know, with Favor, we're ultimately working with, you know, helping organizations, you know, organize themselves in a more efficient way. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the core of the problem that we're interested in and we're helping people with. So, you know, remote first, you know, hybrid, various degrees of hybrid, et cetera. I mean, it's still a very, very topical question. And when it gets into the whole, like, you know, what is better, I think hybrid is great. We are a remote first company ourselves at Favro. I think I recognize that, you know, if you make like a plus and minus list for both, there's going to be things both on plus and minus, both for office versus remote first. So it is a choice where you choose between good things and you choose between challenges. And the only, let's say, very, you know, clear or let's call it opinionated advice that I have that I really feel like I can stand behind is that whatever you choose, you have to design for it. Mm-hmm. If you're really an in-office company and all your processes, everything is set up for the environment, and then you're trying to do remote or hybrid, you know, that's going to be painful and suboptimal. And vice versa. So you have to design for it. And so my first question is, do you agree with that statement?
Yeah, 100%. And I liked that you said it's a choice, right? Because I think so much about remote versus office is, it's not even, and you talked about a pros and cons list, and that can be a helpful framing. And I would almost prefer the word trade-off, right? Like what trade-offs are we making implicitly because of this choice? Or like, what are we saying yes to and what are we saying no to? And I completely agree about, yeah, if you're signed up for the choice that you've made, it is so much easier to design with intent for that choice. When you don't make the explicit choice, when you spend your time sort of even like, and this is true for so many things in life and in software development, but if you live in this we haven't made a choice world, you end up arguing about the choice and you don't spend your time designing for it. I think like committing and choosing is actually maybe the more important first step you take, and then from there, the design comes naturally because people are bought into it, or at least they're aware of it and they can, you know, they don't have to spend their energy arguing about it.
Yeah. I think that's very helpful advice. I think, you know, anyone considering these things, you know, you really have to make up your mind. You know, you need to create, there needs to be like a vision. There needs to be a picture of that. You know, what is it that we're trying to achieve with this, and then you start designing. I think that's great. So then going, since we're agreeing on this, let's go a little bit into the details there. So, you know, you talked about talent and recruitment here. So let's talk a little bit about that. When you are looking for talent, and let's put it this way: when you're looking for talent, what are the qualities that might be a little bit specific to the fact that it's, you know, remote first, you know, that you're looking for, and then, you know, what, how do you notice that, you know, that is important that that's the case, you know, once they're in the team.
Sure. And some of these things, I think there's like a few studio values we kind of throw at the bottom of each of our job descriptions. And I think they tend to focus on like all the obvious stuff, like you need to be disciplined, autonomous, that sort of stuff. But some of it is just more like even more practical. It's not even about characteristics of the candidate, but like how much overlap, like how is this team constructed and how much overlap are we going to have with time zones? Do we need more support for folks living over here, or is it okay for this to sort of be more asynchronous or sort of more ad hoc about how we choose to fill that? We're in the process of filling a role where we, on another project, where we knew that our Western European cohort of developers were not getting as much sort of production support. And so we needed to make sure that the candidate was going to have a certain amount of just daylight hours of crossover with them to make sure that they had support. So sometimes it's as simple as that stuff. It definitely, we talk about choices, we talk about trade-offs. And one of the trade-offs we make is that, hey, we want sort of the best candidates around the world, or some of the most diverse pools of candidates around the world. And the trade-off sometimes is like, hey, we want this really great candidate, and we accept that we're going to only have 5 hours of overlap between them and maybe somebody else or their team or something. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but
yeah, but I'm going to hold you a little bit on the kind of, you know, characteristics of the person, because I do think there are differences there. I mean, for example, yeah, it's always dangerous to generalize, and it, you know, you can get a little bit into stereotypes, and some people even, you know, question if there is such a thing as introvert versus extrovert. But if we're gonna go with the somewhat established, kind of idea around introverted preference versus extroverted preference, what I notice is that, at least my impression is that people that are a little bit more, let's say, heavy on the introvert preference, have an easier time shining in a remote first environment. I have some idea why that is, and vice versa. I definitely noticed during COVID when you're speaking with, you know, friends, that a lot of people that didn't have that kind of social environment in the office every day, you know, they were actually struggling a bit. And if I share just one of the things that I thought about as a leader there, was that, you know, my experience that people that are a little bit more on the introverted side, if I just suddenly call them and say, you know, hey, I want your input on this, that might be a disruption. It's not always appreciated, you know, like, well, why are you calling me now? You know, we're supposed to have a meeting tomorrow, you know? Versus, you know, I noticed that it was almost like a little bit the other way around with people that are quite extroverted, that they really appreciated when it was like an unexpected call and a little bit of chit chat, because that was the one thing that they missed the most. These are some simple examples, but how do you think about these things?
I mean, I 100% co-signed so much of what you said. I mean, I think operating in unknown worlds was an adjustment for me, because I classify myself as an extroverted introvert. I am capable of being, you know, being extroverted, but I recharge when I'm by myself, or recharge when I'm doing things alone or quietly. And I think I remember some of the early days in unknown worlds where some of the things I took for granted about being in an office, like, hey, let's do just like a 15-minute stand-up. Like, I had to do so much more salesmanship about like, why is that necessary? Or like, hey, like, you know, the example you gave about calling somebody out of the blue, like, oh, actually, no. Hey, could you actually not call me? Because I prefer to have it by text because it's searchable for me after the fact. Like, it just totally broke my brain at first to kind of reassess even what I bring to the table and what assumptions I've made about what characteristics I have. And so I think we have a tendency to treat our own sort of characteristics as maybe static, like I am an introvert, or I am this way, or I prefer this. But I believe that we all sort of live on a spectrum and we can sort of adjust to our environment. And again, just like signing up for it ends up being the most important thing. So I'm like, okay, I really want to, make sure that we still get this important crosstalk. And I want to make sure that I'm supportive of an environment that found a ton of success before I ever stepped foot into the building. And so I think if we're talking about characteristics of the ideal candidate, I think it's somebody who has the adaptability and flexibility to adjust to meet the specific needs or adjust and make affordances for their colleagues in a way that you might not do if you were just in person. I feel like in-person life ends up with I just feel like we didn't question enough of the assumptions we made there. And working in a distributed environment is allowing me to do that. And I'm also seeing what you said about how, hey, maybe folks who are a little bit more on the quieter side have an opportunity to be more successful just because the constraints have changed.
I
could talk about this like for 28
and
hours
straight. You just made me think about something. We often talk about all the things that's harder as a leader in a remote environment. But one thing that I think is, in a way, it's easier is to really, stay focused on output. You know, I remember writing an article some years ago for a software publication called Output Driven Development, and some tips and tricks around how to do that in a good way. And I think a lot of people and leaders would agree that what's important is the value you create, not as many how many hours you spend in the office, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of that stuff is sometimes a little bit easier said than done. But sometimes, you might have, for example, a company where you have a value that your focus, it's not about who works the most hours, it's about creating value. But even with that, you're still sliding into, kind of behaviors that let's say that you're kind of like an in-office company. It's still going to be, let's say that you have someone who is not only, I actually had a conversation the other week at the conference about this. So let's say that you have a coder who is not only fantastic, but also someone who's working ridiculous hours for
sure,
whatever reason. It's very easy then that turns into, that becomes the norm and turns into culture, because this guy is great. She or he is a hero, kind of setting the tone by that, and then you end up in kind of like a macho culture around in who stays the longest in the office. It's very easy to slide into that even though you didn't intend it. And so my point here is that with remote first, where it's kind of, it's kind of easier to only, you don't get distracted by as many things. Easier to just look at, what does this asset actually look like right now? What is the quality of this code, et cetera, et cetera. It's easier to focus on just the results. I can see that that's actually a benefit, that it's easier to not get sidetracked.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
Since you're in the production part of it, why don't we talk a little bit about talent there? So what's your view on what's the difference between a great producer in an office environment versus a great producer in a remote first environment?
Good question. I think in general, folks who kind of count on And again, we're speaking in generalizations here. So take this all with a grain of salt. But I think folks who trade on sort of office, I don't want to say office politics, but like the office cachet, you know, like the sort of social currencies, I think that that tool tends to be, I think, diminished in this sort of environment. There are fewer, I don't know, there are fewer outside of work events to attend. You know, there are fewer opportunities to gain curry the favor of the boss. You know what I mean? I'm like being really, really general here. And so I would say that the folks who count on that to be successful, and I think it's not just the cynical stuff. I think there is in general, like folks who are more on the extroverted end or more on the like counting on more of a pinging system, like validation, like externally valid people who count on external validation. You really, again, you need people, you need producers in particular who are intrinsically motivated or who are disciplined and able to operate even if they don't have, there isn't like a social reward for doing that. And so I do think it center, again, there are many times where I think working remotely sort of centers the work being done more than maybe how you're doing the work or rewarding people who do it a certain way, which I like. But again, I think like most of the same stuff for producers still applies. Like I talk all the time about how I'll take persistence over perfection any day of the week. Like for the most part, like if I've got a producer who they might not do it the ideal way, but they will just keep at it until they find a solution. Like they treat things with curiosity and that persistence. Like that is even more necessary in a work culture because now you have an asynchronous communication. The clock is different. Like there's so much about how that works differently that you need folks who aren't going to stop when the first thing they tried didn't work. So yeah, I would say probably persistence. The what motivates the individual, that stuff I think comes up a lot for me when I'm looking at successful producers.
One thing that comes to mind for me is also a bit on, let's say, leadership style. I think, you know, if we kind of put there's a lot of misconceptions around what servant leadership means. So let's interpret it, you know, generously here and not get sidetracked by that whole conversation. but let's say that we kind of make a bit of an axis here where with servant leadership on one end and micromanager on the other. It is more complex than that. But just for simplification, I think, you know, no one really likes a micromanager, but I think it becomes more critical to be able to lead without micromanaging in a remote first environment, because micromanaging over Zoom, I mean, that's just a horrible idea. And also, you know, there's so, you know, you need to work in a more asynchronous way when you're remote first. And I think that's also one of the benefits. I mean, they can actually unlock a lot of efficiency. And it's probably also very key, you know, with time zones. But if you're going to do that successfully from a leadership point of view, you know, you can't rely upon micromanagement as your method for ensuring alignment. You know, you need to be successful in other ways. I mean, you know, do you agree? Do you see where I'm going with that?
You're reminding me of a point that I nearly vomited at you earlier, but I forgot about it. But you were talking about sort of like what's the pitch for Unknown Worlds, and so I think we're talking about like leadership styles and micromanagement. And I do think that when you lead with this sort of asynchronous culture, we talk a lot, I think, in production about decentralized decision making, especially as a team grows. I mean, even past 20, 30 people, like it doesn't take long before, you know, you have your director can no longer make every decision. And so the ideal is you end up with this environment where the larger you grow, the more decision making is decentralized because people understand why about something and they act with autonomy. And so to bring this back around to my point, right, is like, I think remote first sort of forces decentralized decision-making because you literally can't be there at every hour that your team is going to be there because they're all across the globe. And you sort of, and again, we talk about signing up for it. And one of the things we sign up for here is that you will be expected to act autonomously. And that is a two-way street of trust, right? You trust that people are going to set the appropriate supportive context for you. And you will trust that they won't micromanage your work. They will give you time to go, hey, you have an itch, like, you know, you want to see the feature explored in this way. Like, guess what? You have an opportunity to go scratch it because nobody's watching or measuring every single last hour of your time. And so, yeah, I mean, we struggle with this, of course. I'm not saying we do this perfectly. We struggle with this in a million different ways. However, I do think because we've signed up for that choice, there's this sort of two-way, there's more two-way trust and autonomy sort of like baked into the culture here. So it tends to happen less that you're micromanaged just because of how things are set up.
How do you, I mean, you mentioned time zones here. I mean, do you have, what kind of learnings have you come to on, you know, how to actually manage that?
I think accepting it is a huge part of it. We tend to select for individuals who are accepting of the like occasional chaos that calls. And you also accept that sometimes somebody's not going to show up, right? Like, you know, they have, hey, this is 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. for somebody. Yes, it's the only time the rest of us could do it. And this ties into the point about decentralizing decision making. Or sometimes you learn about the things that you can let go of a little bit. You can take your hand off the wheel a little bit because you're recording the meeting or you're sending a follow-up or you're asynchronously communicating about this thing after the fact. So I think just, you know, your tolerance just increases and improves for what a successful collaboration looks like. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. and it made me think about, I don't know why I actually thought about that, but would you say that you are a more flat organization that you would have been if you were in office, or the other way around, that you're more hierarchical?
I'm having a hard time. Like the flat hierarchical conversation is a trigger conversation for me, so I'm having a hard time not going into that in detail.
Go into detail. I want to hear.
The short story is that no, I don't believe that any organization is flat, right? And by saying you're flat, you make it difficult for people to navigate your culture, right? So that's all I'm going to say about that. And I would say, that said, I do think that Unknown Worlds has, as we have grown over the last few years, we have accepted the necessity for a more explicit sort of like structure for how we treat decision making and that sort of stuff. I think what's important is to not get, again, I've said this a couple of times, but let's not get lost in a shorthand like flat versus hierarchical. Let's not argue about what those words mean to us. Let's instead talk about what's important to us. What is important to me to preserve about what flat means to somebody, rather than let's not get into it again, a taxonomical mm-hmm. sort of argument about like what is flat even to begin with. So yes, the short answer is we are talking a lot more internally now about more traditional like reporting structures and why we have the need for that and people seeing the need for that and that sort of stuff. So that's like, you know, every studio, every software team is like an evolution of resulting from it shifting context, right? Like we've grown or this project is different. So it's really just healthy to be thinking about that stuff.
Yeah, I think, probably, you know, in practice, we agree with each other. And you know, to me, you know, flatter hasn't been, let's say, trigger. So it was actually very interesting that you said that. I mean, you know, if I can just lay out the text a little bit. You know, what I mean by it is that, I mean, often when I, okay, so I need to take a step back here. So there's this, you know, in organizational theory, you know, there's this one idea, which is, I think, is pretty strong, which is that companies are going through various stages of maturity, and it's a life cycle, and then in the end they die because they basically become more and more bureaucratic. In the final step they die. And I have a friend, you know, Kim. He recently released a book called Up Down Up, which is about, you know, really the business of the game industry. There was a lack of really like a good kind of like business book. And it's based upon a ton of interviews with industry leads. It's a very good book. I can recommend it to anyone. So there you go, Kim. You know, that's your plug. I'm not paid for it, but it's a good book. And he's applying, you know, this model of maturity at, you know, to the game industry, and he's taking some very concrete examples. Now the idea with this is that, you know, what you need to do as a CEO or executive leader here is that, you know, this will take you on a path to death unless you basically disrupt yourself. You know, you need to pull yourself back into earlier stages. For example, if you have been growing and now you've been going flat and you're starting to become this dinosaur, you know, it's like how do we put this company back to growth again? You know, we need to jump back one phase. So it's like, you know, how do you do that? So this is a lot of that stuff. Now, so what does this have to do with hierarchy? Well, one of the most common things I see with companies that have maybe been very innovative, they have been growing very nicely, they have been attracting fantastic talent, people have said it's super nice to work at this place, and then suddenly, you know, it's not. You know, now it's not growing, people think it's very bureaucratic, etc. If I then start looking at the details of what often happens, is that you know, they might during the glory years, so to say, have had a culture where, you know, each team had a relatively large autonomy and they were relatively self. I mean, if you take the classic, you know, like don't tell, you know, tell the team, you know, what to do, tell them why this is important, you know, make sure that the resources are there, but don't tell them exactly what to do. Let the team figure that out themselves. You know, that's a good principle. And if you have that very well working, it's also a very nice environment to be in. But what I've seen happen in some companies, I'm not going to name any here, but it's that, you know, you become, you know, that decision power is suddenly taken away by that team, and now is owned by a single VP who might not always be the really know what that person is doing. Sure. And then you have these like hierarchies of EVPs and SVPs and EVPs, and it just become this very, very hierarchical thing. So when I think about, you know, what I mean by flat is that if you have, let's say 300 people in your organization, you know, how many hierarchical levels do you have? And you know, how much of your innovation and decisions are actually happening on the team level? And if it's many levels and the people in the teams are basically just cogs in a machine, that might not be the best organization if you are in the business of creativity and innovation. It might be great for some other situations. So, you know, when I'm saying flat, you know, I don't really mean like 100% flat, you know?
Yeah, it's just,
I guess what I mean is, you know, flatter than what, you know, the opposite would be. And I mean, what I think, you know, from what you said is that I think when you are remote first, I think you're forced. I think the norm, so to say, and what you gravitate to is, let's say, flat, you know, you still need hierarchy. And I think we agree with each other. I think it's incredibly important, the clarity on that. And like, you, I think you probably have to invest more in, let's say, the clarity of what does the hierarchy and the, you know, kind of, line of command, what does that actually mean, you know, in a remote first organization? So that's not fluffy. So I think the clarity is super important. But I still think that if you're going to have a thriving remote first organization, you know, you still need, you can't take away that kind of like team empowerment. But you know, yeah, that was a bit of a
spiel for me here. You know, I'll shut up now. You know, back to you. I mean,
no, it's
fine. More reflections on this.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few things that stood out to me from what you said, right? Like, I feel like one thought that I had is like when you talk about how do you, again, how do you decentralize decision making? Yeah, it's great to talk about that as an ideal, but how do you actually do that in practice if you're working with a group that does, you know, you so many times you have people who get to where they are, let's say as a VP or whatever, a lead, because they display these qualities. And then now nobody ever taught you, how do you set context for your team? How do you frame what is the goal in a way that allows your team to take ownership of it while giving you the tools you need to hold them accountable? I feel like nobody gets trained to do that. And really, I think some of the most successful leaders, emerging leaders that I work with, are the ones who understand that they don't know. I'm trying not to swear right now. I'm getting excited. They don't know everything. And to go seek out what they don't know, right? Like, what coaching can I take, or what classes can I take? Like, whatever that looks like. So I do think that as people are changing context in their careers, they need to be thinking about that stuff, and realize that the tools that you use to hold the people around you accountable need to get more sophisticated. And sometimes that's a combination. It doesn't mean you necessarily have to take your hand off the wheel, but you do need to loosen your grip. And you need to behave differently with them. This is something I've been thinking about. I had a really interesting conversation with my boss yesterday about how do we go about framing the problem we're trying to go solve with people, instead of just barreling forward with whatever solution we think is the right one. So that's one thought. And then the other is really like, I don't know.
Well, let me
catch
you.
We were talking about so much. Yeah, please. Yeah,
let me catch you on one thing that you said that I would like to hear more about. You know, you mentioned accountability, and I find that accountability is actually very hard, much harder than people think it is. It was was a great talk at the GDC this year by Ben Kajic from the Building Better Games podcast, which I think is amazing. And he did an
Please send me that link.
Oh yeah,
I would love to watch it.
Definitely do it afterwards. I mean, it is such a great talk. And he was basically giving like a model for that. And I should maybe plug that here, that he will be coming on my podcast. So we will be talking about that. So there's gonna be some discussion around that with him. But I want to ask you, your take on it. How do you hold leaders reporting to you accountable? How do you coach them to hold the teams accountable? In a remote first environment.
Yeah, this is something that I think I will be a student of the rest of my career. This is not something you just create a process or you write an algorithm for and you run it and it just works. Every situation is different. Everybody sort of has different things that motivate them and different things that work for them. And so as a producer, I am all about something that I believe in is reducing problems often to their simplest components, right? And so for me, accountability often stems from like our expectations are misaligned. So how do we examine that? How do we discuss it? How do we unpack it? And then, so often when I'm working with leads for the first time, I usually, it's almost like working on a contract with a new vendor. The contract is there for when things go wrong, not for your day-to-day, right? And so you're setting expectations with folks with the idea that hopefully we will never have to refer back to this, but if we do, we did the work now to do that. And so anytime I'm finding that, hey, I'm having trouble holding this person accountable, it's usually because I'm skipping steps. I'm like rushing through the process, or we were too busy to really do a big alignment phase on what are our expectations. And then from there, when we're holding people accountable, there's no shortcut around just having the conversations the moment they crop up. So it's like, hey, I noticed you weren't available, or I noticed this thing wasn't successful. You know, what do you need from me to be successful? And also, hey, you didn't meet my expectations. And so there's so much in there. My wife, Melanie, has some, I'm like always borrowing phrases from her. And I think this is a moment where the only way out is through, which means the only way to finish the hard thing is to work through it. And sometimes the intention to do it is almost more important than doing it perfectly or doing it particularly skillfully. So yeah, the idea of holding people accountable, I don't think there's a silver bullet. I think you just have to care about it and you have to work at it.
So I have a question. You're working with external partners, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how do you... the reason I'm so curious about this are twofold. You know, one is, again, at GDC this year, there was quite a bit of talk around that when it comes to large productions, many studios will not be scaling their teams as much as they probably would have done in the past and rely more upon external partners,
sure.
Which I think is a good idea. And the second reason I'm very interested in this is because Favre is really powerful when it comes to making external partners more like an extension of your team rather than like throwing things over the wall.
Yeah.
I have a vested interest also in this. But you know, just can you speak a little bit to excellence around this? Like, you know, how to work with external partners, you know, well, a little bit like do's and don'ts, you know, around that, because you have a lot of experience with it.
I mean, this is a pretty fun segue from accountability, right? And it's I feel like so many of the lessons are the same here, right? Like you need to set up, you need to do a lot of work generally upfront for setting expectations with your partners. And that's a two-way street, because I think we've certainly worked with partners before that we ended up being a bad fit for them and vice versa. And so, yeah, I think there's a big part there's importance in not shortcutting your alignment phases up front. And so making sure, hey, do they understand the work here? Do they understand the timeline? Because externals can mean co-developer arrangements. It can mean outsourced studios. It can mean individual contractors. And I think when you start to get into individual contractors, it becomes even more important to make sure, like, hey, are we signed up mutually for like a situation we both signed up for? Is this, you know, what are the expectations of this vendor over the duration of this project? And what are our expectations of them? I think it's just important to cover that in the early phases. And then from there, I think we are very open with our vendors as well. Like we try to make sure that they have direct contact, not just with like a production contact where, you know, like the worst, you know, some of the worst situations we've all probably been in, right, are like we're working through somebody in the middle who's acting as an intermediary when really we just want to have a face-to-face conversation. The best situations overall are making sure that we have contact with the people generally who are doing the work. And not all studios are set up to do it that way. Some external outsource vendors in particular like to work through like a project manager to make sure they're protecting their team. And I think there's even components to it about like protecting their talent from being poached. I'm sure that's a concern from them. Let me stop myself there. And is this sort of yielding?
No, but I think that's very helpful. And I think one of the big takeaways for any business, you know, leader in this industry, independent on if you're at a, you know, venture backed new studio or if you're at an established studio, is that, you know, the difference between a good setup in your collaboration with external partners versus a not so great setup.
Right.
You know, the difference is massive in terms of what quality you will get for your game, in terms of how much it's going to cost you, in terms of what kind of, you know, iteration speed you can have, you know, to create learning. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, just in pure dollars, the difference between doing it well and doing it not so well is massive. And I think that's, something that, you know, everyone, you know, really should pay attention to. And I think you're forced to do, I think it's probably easier to do a good job at it when you're remote first, because it's, you know, some of the kind of workflows around, you know, good collaboration when you're not in the same place are already there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're making such a great point about, like, they're like aligning our incentives is even important, right? Like, at the end of the day, if I can help the vendor feel invested in what we're trying to build, all the better, right? Like, I remember with Moonbreaker, there was a time where we were working with a vendor, and we made sure in every case that we were offering them Steam keys to the game. We had another vendor where we included them in a playtest that we were running with our team. And I just, it's not just about sort of like esprit de corps, you know, it's not just like a sense of belonging and that sort of thing, but also like we're counting on these people to make choices as well. And these are human beings at the other end of this relationship. And I think you have so many litigious companies out there. And so, I think if you focus too much on like, hey, how could this collaboration go wrong? Then you're missing opportunities to build things with your vendors as well, and treating them like they're people who are just, in some cases, invested as you are in the outcome of this project. So, yeah.
Yeah, cool. And I should, you know, I'm grateful for the, you know, the recording, you know, we did, you know, the video that we did where you were showcasing, you know, how you were using automations in Favro to be able to, you know, have a sign-off process for like an art director where it doesn't really matter if it's coming from internal or external, you know, it just shows up in a simple view for that art director to, you know, to sign off. I thought that was a good example of where, you know, you in a very positive way can blur the line between internal and external.
Right.
So, cool. Thanks for that. This was, you know, time flies. You know, I think we can.
I know we went.
We
long.
Can talk for. Yeah, we can. We can talk forever.
I warned you. But, I will. I like to talk. I do not mind.
I think everything was very crisp. So cool. This was awesome. You know, thank you so much.
Yeah. Cheers, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
I hope you liked that interview. If you did, you know what to do. Share it on your favorite social media so others can learn from the Favro community.